Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in chapter 14. We've come to verse 28. We're in the narrative dealing with the aftermath of Absalom's murder of his brother Amnon and all of the political fallout of that. Absalom had to flee to avoid being killed by his family. He went back to his roots in Geshur. Joab interceded in behalf of Absalom, and David let Absalom come back, but virtually not quite under house arrest. And we read, now Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem. Here's a problem. He did not see the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king. But Joab would not come to him. He wasn't responsive to Absalom's request. So he sent again a second time, but Joab would not come, still is the idea. Therefore, Absalom, ever rash, said to his servants, see, Joab's field is next to mine. He has a barley crop there. Just go out and set it on fire. And Absalom's servants set the field on fire. That got Joab's attention. Joab arose, came to Absalom at his house, and he said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? Absalom answered Joab, I'm paraphrasing, well, I'll tell you why. I sent for you, I've said time and again, come here that I may send you to the king with a message. I wanted you to go ask the king why I have come from Geshur. The king brought me back, but this is no way to treat a son. It would have been better for me to still be there. Now therefore, use your good offices to let me see the king's face. I'm paraphrasing, you understand. If there's some iniquity or wrong in me, then let him put me to death. Otherwise, get me back on level ground again is the idea. So Joab came to the king and told him what Absalom said, and the king called for Absalom. Absalom came to the king, prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom as a sign of reconciliation. So Absalom is back home. He's living once again in the capital. He's no longer in exile, but he still remains in a status of persona non grata. He's treated as a pariah or a leper as far as David and the royal family are concerned. This whole deal is fraught with all kinds of political complications, as we saw in our recent studies. In all probability, this cold arrangement was not to David's liking, but it was the result of palace politics, where feelings against Absalom ran high, and probably there was no little resentment against David himself as well among the members of the royal family for bringing Absalom back from banishment, Absalom who had killed his half-brother Amnon. Well, as I said, things were very complicated. You see, sin has a way of confusing and convulsing human relations and family relations as well as broader social relationships. I feel sure this arrangement with Absalom was probably what David felt was best, the best he could do for Absalom politically. Sometimes when sin enters into life's affairs, it just ramifies in all directions and makes life terribly difficult. David keeping Absalom in Jerusalem on this at-a-distance basis probably placated the hostiles in the royal siblings. They, I'm sure, if Absalom had to be back in the country, wanted to leave Absalom hanging out there in no man's land. Trouble is, Absalom was a man who was not built for virtually house arrest, as I called it earlier. He was a man who had royal roots. He also had royal ambitions. And if you leave a person like that out there to dry up on the vine, you're asking for trouble. Such people, like very large dogs, need a large exercise yard, so to speak. A lot here we can learn about human nature. Finally, Absalom, we see in verse 29, had it with this idle life and this political and social isolation. Nobody would talk to him, none of the family, not even his father, King David. And worse, not even the guy who championed his restoration from exile, his friend Joab, David's great general, chief of staff. Joab probably figured he had pressured David as much as he dared in this matter. I'm guessing Joab felt that it would not serve his own career very well if he kept ringing that bell. In fact, I suspect Joab felt people might begin to wonder if Joab had something up his sleeve. So Joab went along with the official stance, just leaving Absalom, his friend, hanging out there. Absalom would come back, but he would not come into the palace or eat at the king's table like one of the royal inner circle. And that was a slap in the face of the heir apparent. In order to get at the king, Absalom needed an intermediary. The natural choice was Joab, after all. As we pointed out, he had been the one so instrumental in having his ban lifted and enabling him to come in from out of the cold and back into Israel and back into the vicinity of Jerusalem. Absalom's idea was to coax Joab to intercede for him before the king, just to get him an audience. Absalom wanted to know where he stood. Things were maddeningly confusing for him. He was still feeling banished, though he was back in town. Well, you can imagine that wouldn't be a very comfortable feeling, would it? Well, ever persistent, we see Absalom's personality coming through in vivid living colors in verse 30. Willful, bold, audacious, Absalom's going to force a resolution. After no response from Joab the first time he tries to get a message through to him, he tries again, and still Joab would not come and sit down with him and help Absalom get some clarity. It so happened that they had adjoining properties. So Absalom ordered some of his servants to go over to Joab's barley field and flat out set his crop on fire. We've always known this, haven't we? Start a fire and people will come from miles around. Well, that turned the trick. When Joab learned what Absalom had done to his barley crop, yes siree, he came at last running. He demanded an explanation. "Why have your servants set my field on fire, man? You've cost me a heck of a lot of money." Paraphrase. "Well," Absalom told him, "I kept sending for you. You kept ignoring my messages. So I rightly figured if I lit a fire under you, more correctly, under your barley crop, you just might decide to show up for the event. Well, voila, here you are. Imagine that." "Now here's what I want you to do," Absalom said. "I just wanted you to go to the king in my behalf. I wanted you to ask the king this simple question. Why have I come back at the king's request from Geshur?" That is, the place of his previous banishment. "Tell the king I just don't get it. I'm here, but so far as I can see, I may as well be there. I'm walled off from the king. I'm walled off from the royal family. I'm just an outcast. I could be an outcast in Geshur. In fact, given the way things are, I would frankly be better off if I were still there. So, Joab, I want you to intercede for me. I want to see the king's face. In other words, I want to be accepted by my father. I don't want to be treated as a leper. And if, in fact, he sees me as a criminal person, if I'm considered by him guilty as Cain, and if he thinks I deserve this cold treatment, then just off me. Put me to death for what I did. But don't go around telling him treating me like this. Let me in or take me out. It's that simple. Well, the narrator in verse 33 doesn't relate how they squared things where the crops were concerned. Biblical narrative sticks to the issue. What it tells us is significant, and what it doesn't tell us was not important to the Spirit of God in the grand scheme of things. That's not the big issue, so the narrator bypasses it to tell us of Joab's consent to mediate. What Absalom said made sense. And David relents, and he sends for Absalom. Absalom comes to David not as a son so much as a servant and a subject, and he prostrated himself in the fashion of Oriental court habit before David. And David, on his part, did what I am sure he, David, in his merciful nature, had really wanted to do all along, probably what any loving parent would have wanted to do. He put aside royal protocol and formalities, it seems, and he welcomed Absalom with an affectionate kiss. Unfortunately, here's a lesson. The forms of reconciliation sometimes do not measure up to the spirit of reconciliation. Sometimes people nurse their wounds to the point that even if mediators can coax them into a formal reconciliation, by that I mean where people go through all the proper motions, bitterness can still run so deep that inwardly the human heart is still vexed and gnawing on the offense, and later, despite all of that formality, will only break open like a festering sore into something deeply infected and threatening. That's exactly the case here. Absalom had sulked and soured. He had stewed in his juices, and he had chewed on his bone way too long. He had had too much downtime, too much time to nurse his grievances against David and the royal family, and there had been no intervention or apparent understanding of the toxic pool of emotions bound to form in the breast of one so alienated and estranged from those by whom he wanted to be accepted. Now, none of this is to excuse Absalom. You may relate to that in some sphere of your personal life. We can understand how Absalom felt, but we cannot excuse him. Absalom was a deeply flawed man, to say the least. He put himself in this position. He did not handle any of his problems or pain in a godly way leading up to all of this. So he got himself into this emotional and psychological trap by his own doing. David dealt with it the best he could, but Absalom complicated everybody's life by his sin. David was trying to deal with it the best he could without straining relations further in the royal family, because Absalom had murdered one of the family members. He had a case. Amnon was a bad guy. Amnon deserved to go down. But Absalom nor David handled it with due process. And when we get everything all outside the lines of God's will and God's way, as I said before, it just puts a strain on everything, and life gets more and more complicated. The way things unfolded was the plan of God. But on the human side of the equation, one can see that nobody helped matters on their part. God does not cause people to sin. 1,000 times I've said it. God will bend a tree the way it is tilted to serve his purpose. He will let men have their way. He will let them lean in the wind and fall the way they're inclined to, but they're responsible for that lean. Joab may have felt he needed to cover his own tail, but Absalom needed a friend he could talk to, a friend who could explain to him the political dynamics of the situation. He didn't get it. Absalom needed his father to open up and give him a little window of hope, or give him something productive he could do with his time and energy and enormous ability, something like that. So it's easy to see how things had gone so far that a kiss of reconciliation, a handshake and an embrace, as it were by now not a sufficient remedy for a disease left so long to run its own course. And that brings us to the climax of the great tragedy of all of this. In chapter 15 begins a narrative, the account of Absalom's bid to overthrow his father David in his bitterness as king of Israel. Bitterness and ambition form an unholy alliance that's going to result in the disgrace and death of Absalom and in the heartbreak of David and David's humiliation. All of this is the outworking, I remind you, of Nathan's prophecy. That's back in this same book, 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 10 and 11. There Nathan told David the consequences of his great sins in the matters of Bathsheba and the arranged death of Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, all in an effort to cover up his adultery. It's all playing out exactly as prophetically advertised. And there is a great lesson. One, sin has grievous consequences. How many times have we said that? And two, God's word is as good as gold. In time, it will happen, rightly understood, exactly as the Lord said, declared the prophet to David in the wake of all of that. Now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, the Lord told David. You've not taken me seriously. And you have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, the prophet says to David, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. And I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, Absalom. And he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, what you did secretly. But I'm going to do this thing before the eyes of all Israel and under the sun. Well, we haven't seen all that yet, but we're seeing the build-up to it. And it's all going to play out just as the Lord said. Folks, all of us need to take the Lord seriously in what he says. In all these narratives, the reader must recognize that the details, they're compressed, they're selective. The Spirit-inspired author tells us what we need to know for his purposes. He doesn't relate all of the in-between stuff that we're curious about, perhaps, and would really like to know. What is important is that Absalom, nursing his grievances and boiling with ambition as David ages, he sets out to win a big following in Israel. And when we say in Israel, we're thinking primarily of the always jealous 10 northern tribes, as opposed to Judah. And he wants to vault himself to the throne in his father's place. Absalom is the devil's tool. And like the devil in all of this, he's very cunning in his treasonous stratagems. He exploits every advantage that he has, and he exploits every weakness that might make David vulnerable to a coup d'etat. Well, about 4 years after his return from this exile, Absalom set to work his plan. Now apparently back in King David's good graces, now able to operate freely, the presumptive heir to the throne, though we're about to see he had no intention of waiting for David to die, and that to occur naturally, Absalom started to work on his image almost Hollywood style. With his incredibly good looks, he was somebody right out of central casting. To his physical charisma, he now added some royal accoutrements. We read, now it came about after this, verse 1, that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses, 50 men as runners before him. To impress the public with his airs, he started playing the royal part even if it was not yet his time to do so. You just have to wonder if David's losing his grip about this time. We don't know just how old David was at this point. We don't know more particularly just how far advanced into his 40-year reign David was when all this show of Absalom started to unfold. But here is what I think we can safely assume, given what we know, and just the atmosphere of the narrative. David, by this time, whatever that time is somewhat fatigued and war-weary, and added to all that, and this may be the most important factor, David seems to be somewhat beaten down psychologically by Nathan's prophecy, and he's seeing them play out. And I would suspect that that has discouraged him somewhat. My guess is that he's maybe a little distracted by palace intrigues, and we see that very thing in several of the Psalms. In short, one gets the sense that David, who in his earlier years was always so acute, so decisive, so on top of things, so discerning, as an administrator, he's clearly less so than he used to be. At this point, David seems vulnerable, whereas before this awful thing with Bathsheba, he didn't used to be. The narrative kind of projects a king that is less confident and, morally speaking, seems a little paralyzed and confused, largely because his sin has morally compromised him. He doesn't seem to feel that he has the same moral high ground that he did before. His eye does not seem to be quite as much on the ball as formerly. Now, I, as an interpreter, am not the only one to pick up on those things. As a result, there were probably some lapses in David's due diligence in the administration of justice. There were probably some trickle-down lapses of zeal in taking care of royal business. And those lapses created some pockets of unrest in his kingdom and among his officials. And if we're right about all of this, and I think we probably are, it all explains how Absalom could so easily, over a short time, succeed in alienating the affections of the nation to the degree that he was able to make a really strong play for the throne. He came within a gnat's whisker of seizing it and holding it. There was a prevailing sense that David's time had come and gone, and a sense that it was time for a fresh face and youthful energy on the throne. And who better for this than this impressive son of his, Absalom? And there is a very dangerous thing, and one sees it a lot in church life, and it might be good to talk about it. For what happened then is instructive about what still happens and the sometimes ugly outcomes. God had put David on the throne. It was God's place to remove David when that time came. God might do that through death or disability, or perhaps a decision of David himself to say that my time has come and gone. Or it was possible, I suppose, that by consensus of the elders of the nation, had they been moved by the Lord, they might have tried to persuade David, or any other king, that it was time to step down. The point is, God can bring about those changes directly or indirectly, but it is never God's approved way for an unofficial cabal of conspirators to work the angles to displace a man whom God has appointed. I'm going to have to come back to this point in our next study. But I hope you'll join me, because this is a very important application of what we see going down here between Absalom and David. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.
Be sure the word gets in their hands.